Good afternoon. We don't have a quorum yet, but I want to get the meeting started because we've got a lot of things on our agenda today. So we will officially convene the meeting when a quorum does appear. But for now, thank you for all who are here on time. I would like to welcome to the Ways and Means Committee, back to the Ways and Means Committee, Commissioner of Finance Peggy Ingeson.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. I think our plan here today is to just give you a brief overview of the governor's revised recommendations, the supplemental recommendations that he announced last week. And I do have some other folks here from the finance department in case you get into some specifics on the details. But, Mr. Chair and members, my intention would be to just kind of go over this at a fairly high level. And in your packet, you should have a document that has several pages, but on the top it says Governor's Supplemental Recommendations. And Mr. Chairman and members, basically as a result of the February forecast that showed improvements in the general fund of $234 million, this translated, when we overlaid the forecast changes onto the governor's recommendations that he had made in January, there's actually a difference of $225 million. And so you'll see here kind of at a high level how the governor dealt with that. The main changes in the governor's recommendations, the bulk of the additional dollars he's recommending go to education, K-12 education, and you'll see there at the top of the sheet there's a total of various items that total $108 million. The most significant part being an increase in the K-12 formula that initially in the governor's recommendations he was recommending 2% per year on the general education formula. With this recommendation it would be 2.5% a year. And then there's also an item for special education, the excess cost aid. This is actually about $11 million each year, an ongoing expense. Also, Mr. Chair, the governor recommended augmenting his initial recommendation for the quality compensation program, performance pay, and has added $14 million to that to basically get the dollars per student up from $225 to $260, the dollars per students for districts that are willing to be part of that change in the way they pay their teachers. In addition, Mr. Chair, there's a one-time item of addition for $5 million to add for expenses related to encouraging districts to get the advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs in both middle schools and high schools. That's a $5 million item. Also, so an additional $1 million for the best practices grants for teacher training, which initially had been zeroed out in the governor's initial recommendation. Some of the other ongoing items in the governor's recommendation, you'll see a list here. There's a number of small items. First of all, for the Department of Health, trauma centers to sort of expand what's happening in the metro area statewide to create trauma centers. An initiative for faith-based initiatives to have some coordination of those efforts in the Department of Administration for $300,000. A couple of items related to the dairy livestock task force. An item for $200,000 related to research on emissions and odor. And then another item to assist local folks involved in siting those facilities. There's also $400,000 for expanding the authority for and to do some of the analysis for DNA sampling and to include a broader number of arrested folks in the DNA sampling. Also an item, Financial Crimes Task Force. This is funding that would go through the Department of Public Safety, really related to the increase, recent increase in the identity theft and trying to put some efforts into looking at that. Also, Mr. Chair and members, there's an item that adjusts the child care rates that were frozen in this in the governor's recommendation. They were also frozen in the current biennium. There's some particular impacts in rural areas where, in fact, some providers not just were frozen but actually had a decrease. This would make sure that there wasn't a decrease in the rural child care provider reimbursement. Also, kind of a phase-in over 4 years to reduce the gross premium tax for life insurance companies from 2% to 1.5%. And then there's a couple of one-time items, an investment tax credit. This would go to venture capital funds, provide venture capital funds in the rural areas. Also, Mr. Chair, members, you may recall that the governor in his initial recommendation had a requirement to pay the sales tax on leased vehicles at the time that the agreement is initially entered into, and this provides some funding to basically modify that slightly to delay that a number of months and also to allow for a kind of a rollover if people don't complete their vehicle lease. Can be the dollars that they paid in sales tax could be rolled over into a new lease. There are a number of small items that cost a little less than $9 million that really go to correcting errors and omissions and items in the initial recommendation of the governor's budget. And then basically, the last item here is what we're calling a federal transition reserve. There's been a lot of discussion about what might be happening at the federal level with the president's budget and the fact that Congress is looking to make significant changes in both entitlement and non-entitlement programs. It could be that we're expecting that things might be more than the usual change at the federal level in funding. So what we're looking at, because this won't be known to us basically until after the budget is set at the state level, the governor's recommending setting aside $75 million in what he's calling a federal transition reserve. And to be clear, this wouldn't necessarily be related to just replacing federal funding if it's reduced from a program, but to provide some time or transition to so that programs aren't sort of abruptly eliminated, that this would provide some time for what we're calling kind of a soft landing or a transition where there may be changes in federal funding. So this is money, Mr. Chair and members, that would be set aside in a reserve and would be available to be directed to particular areas in the next legislative session after it's known what the federal changes would be. And basically, Mr. Chair and members, the governor's recommendations leaves a little over $10 million on the bottom line. And what follows this cover letter that is a cover letter that goes to the legislative leadership that describes this as these official changes to the governor's recommendations. Then you'll see there's a few what we call our appendix tables that just basically make comparisons showing you what the original governor's recommendation was, what it is with these revisions, so you can see the highlighted difference in that column. The third column there. And then you'll see there's also the governor's recommendations, the updated recommendations relative to the new forecast. And again, highlighting the differences there, you'll see the changes that are being made from the forecast as part of the governor's budget recommendations. And then the last appendix table just shows the two-year numbers for the current biennium, 06-07, and the 08-09 long-term planning estimates as a result of the governor's recommendations. Mr. Chair, what follows are a number of, kind of in a spreadsheet format, all of the things that are changes in this recommendation of the governor. The first few pages are what we're calling the budget fixes. These are the first several pages are what we would call the budget fixes, and you'll see that there's a description, very brief description about what's being changed from the original governor's recommendations. Into that a little further, you'll see that There's a little bit more information still in the same format for the items, new items in the governor's supplemental recommendation. So you'll see each of the new items has a paragraph describing it. Mr. Chair and members, in addition, there are budget change pages for all these new items and corrected pages for the other items, and those will be transmitted to the, or if not, if they haven't already been, transmitted to the individual budget committees and finance committees that will deal with those areas. So there'll be individual change pages for each of those items. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Commissioner, before we take questions, why don't I officially convene the meeting? I'll ask the clerk to note the roll. I'll verify that there is a quorum. And members, we have the minutes of the last meeting in your packets. That would be the minutes of the March 10th meeting. Are there any corrections, additions, or changes to the minutes of the March 10th meeting? Representative Sikora moves approval of the minutes of the March 10th meeting. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. All right, back to Commissioner Ingerson. Commissioner Ingerson, let me ask the first question. When I'm looking at the bottom line number, I see $225 million. When the forecast came out, I recalled we had $234 million. At the start of your comments, I think you said that there were $9 million in budget changes that were needed to conform to the governor's original recommendations. I'm wondering, what is the difference between the $9 million, between that $9 million and the approximate $9 million you've got listed here in miscellaneous budget fixes?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll take a... I do have one copy of a sheet. I'll try to see if I can work the technology here. Because I actually have a sheet that kind of walks through what the changes are. And let me maybe first, while I'm trying to figure that out...
Well, send an assistant up to you, Commissioner.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I know I need one, too.
But, Mr. Chair, let me just give you a couple of examples of the things that probably have changed this. You'll see up here, there we go, on the screen that a sheet that shows the governor's initial recommendations, his updated recommendations, and what the change is. And you'll see that, in fact, as part of the forecast, there was $234 million new on the bottom line. The governor actually had a, as part of his initial recommendation, oh, good, it makes it a little closer. It's a little bit bigger there.
Well, I think we can read it on these side ones up here in many cases, too.
Okay. Mr. Chair, what we needed to do once we had the updated forecast is, because that's the reference point to that forecast was a change from November, and we had the governor's recommendation kind of intervene in between the November and the February forecast. And so what we did was then have to do another set of calculations to say, how does the cost of the governor's various recommendations change now relative to the February forecast? For example, in the forecast there was a change in K-12 education. The forecast had an increase in the number of students, and that forecast change was basically about $44 million. So as a result of that, because the governor was recommending an increase in the general education formula, because there are more students, that recommendation of the governor's would cost more. So even before he starts talking about his supplemental recommendations, there's a change here in education, about $65 million. This includes the cost of the increase in the forecast plus his initial recommendations. Likewise, in the Health and Human Services area, there were some items that were included in the forecast, but it also been new recommendations for the governor. The biggest piece of this was the deficiency items that were included in the governor's recommendation. But that deficiency bill passed subsequent to his recommendation. Now it becomes current law, so that there are actually some savings when we make a comparison in the governor's budget, but there were forecast savings as well. So all the repricing basically leaves you with this far right column here with a change from the initial recommendations from the governor of about $217 million when you count that $8 million that was originally left on the bottom line in the governor's recommendations. So that's why this sheet that I went through on the cover kind of goes through the 225 as the new number, basically what's available after repricing the cost of the governor's initial recommendations. And Mr. Chair, you asked about the that item called miscellaneous budget fixes. There's a number of small items that you'll see detailed in the pages that follow in the spreadsheet format pages, but let me just give you an example of one large item, because I think it's kind of the bulk of it. There was an item in the forecast, hang on a second, I'm wondering if we're calling this a new item. No, I think we're calling it a budget, one of the miscellaneous budget fixes. But what happened is that the Department of Human Services had an funding in the current biennium to do some transition to the community services for mental health programs, transition from regional treatment centers into community services, and this was an item that would result in some cost savings down the road. They haven't been able to get it done as quickly as possible, so that funding cancels at the end of this biennium. So in our forecast, we recognized that funding wouldn't be spent in the current biennium, so the governor's recommending continuation of that funding in the next biennium. So you'll see that in that item under budget fixes, and there's a number of other items that that's the largest of the items, Mr. Chair.
So I guess, is it fair to say, Commissioner, that when you look at the $225 million number, that number is there because of changes in the forecast, more students being in K-12 than originally assumed, for example, whereas the miscellaneous budget fix number is maybe more a compilation of items that were supposedly going to be in the first forecast, but through perhaps a mistake in them not being in there or something didn't get in the first forecast?
Mr. Chair, what I would just do to correct slightly what you said, in order to make sure that there's a clear understanding that when we do the forecast, it's strictly current law. So we don't build any of these things that are requiring a change in law, like in the governor's recommendations, like, for example, this Department of Human Services item could not be included in the forecast because current law would have that funding cancel. So that has to be in the governor's budget recommendation. So I think just to kind of clarify, we're strictly looking at the forecast as current law, repricing of the governor's recommendations as a separate item. So, you know, I know that it gets to be sort of a confusing time, but we have to make kind of distinct reference points here along the way, and so that's what we're doing here with kind of the November forecast, governor's initial January budget, February forecast, repricing of the governor's original budget, and on that new forecast, and then new budget recommendations.
Well, thank you. I wanted to make that clear because I know a lot of people were expecting there to be a 234 number at the bottom and not a 225, and I thought we'd start off by making sure that people had a chance to understand that. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Ingerson, what would be page number 7 where you start into the budget fixes? First one there is the State Airports Fund. It has a 15, a negative 15 in each of the next 4 years. At 15,000, 15 million, 15,000.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's $15,000.
And that's from an overestimation of fuel tax, I see. Okay. It is thousands. That's what I'm going to be sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, that is actually in the governor's recommendations, he's recommending, so it's not just a forecast as in current law. The governor is just recommending a change here to his initial budget, and he's recommending that there be an exemption of fuel taxes to air ambulances.
All right.
And this would cause this much of a loss to the State Airports Fund, $15,000. per year. And it's shown here in the budget fixes because of the fact that in his initial set of recommendations, we left out the cost, but the language to do this change is included in the tax bill.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Commissioner Engeson? Seeing none. Commissioner Engeson, thank you very much for coming down and going over the supplemental budget with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay, next we'll go to Representative Smith and House File 1109. Okay. Members, we've got a number of small bills, three specifically that are here with us, just because they've got small fiscal impacts. People recall House Rule 4.03 that when a bill has a fiscal impact now or perceived fiscal impact in the future, it's supposed to come to Ways and Means. And there's not a lot of money here, but I thought we still ought to make sure that we have a chance to look at these bills. With that, and I want to thank Representative Smith for bringing forth this bill. Representative Smith moves that House File 1109 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you. Two things on this bill. First of all, I want to give you just a very quick procedural background on the bill, and then the second thing is to address the $5,000 amount that's in the fiscal note. First of all, this bill established the Firefighters Training Board back in 2000, and just as a note here, it passed the House on 124-6 vote and passed the Senate on 63-0 vote. And basically, the board was established to develop a consistent set of standards for the training of Minnesota firefighters to ensure that whoever showed up as a firefighter was trained. And this is especially important after 9-1-1, because firefighting techniques have expanded to include hazardous materials, emergency medical treatment, adverse climate, working environment, extrication, confined space, structural firefighting, traffic safety, protective clothing, and the list is a long one. The board had a sunset date that frankly was passed. History is that the funding was stripped under the Ventura administration. The board continued to work without noticing the sunset. Sometime between then and now, a $5,000 gift was given to the state, and Mr. Erdman here can be more specific, but that sum of money lies in the state coffers in, I believe, the gift fund. So the reason we're here is to make note of that and request that that amount be recognized to zero out the amount in the gift fund and see to it that it winds up going to the board where it can be spent. Mr. Chairman, that's all.
Discussion or questions for Representative Smith? Seeing no discussion. Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 1109 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is Representative Blaine here? He's on his way down. Representative Lesh, are you here? He stepped out. Okay. Is Mr. Walls here? Going down our agenda today.
Right.
Mr. Crow here from the Education Finance Overview.
We didn't know how to find him, so I go get him.
Okay, here's Representative Blaine. All right. Representative Blaine, you just saved us from having to take a temporary recess.
We're not going to let that happen.
Well, we almost did. Representative Blaine, welcome to the House Ways and Means Committee.
I'm just delighted to be here, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sure you are.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 823 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register.
Representative Seifert moves that House File 823 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. And I see there's an amendment here. Representative Blaine, would you like to explain House File 823 first, or would you like us to offer the amendment? I assume this is an amendment that is coming from you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is an author's amendment. And Mr. Chair, with the committee's purview, I'd just soon pass the amendment and get the bill in the shape we wanted in. I think this amendment actually deals with probably the area of the bill that would be most interested by this committee.
Okay, the chair will move the A2 amendment. Representative Blaine, can you explain the A2 amendment to us?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment, the A2 amendment has to deal with permits that are given out by the Department of Natural Resources to salvage or cut waste wood that is used for fuel wood. We made a change from the language that was currently in the bill, and this is an issue that Representative Osment, Chairman Osment of the Environment Finance Committee, had brought up to take a look at taking the dollar value basically out of the fuel wood costs, and this would allow the commissioner of DNR to allow a permit that would cover the department's expense for issuing the permit and not to exceed the cost of fuel wood. And that's basically the fuel wood amendment.
Any discussion to the amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? More prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Blaine to the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I can go right through the bill with you if that be your purview.
I don't think, Representative Blaine, that we need an exhaustive explanation of the bill unless people really want one. I guess maybe you could tell us about the highlights of the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, this bill is the timber policy bill, members for the Department of Natural Resources. I'll go real quickly through the bill section by section. Section one basically defines terms that are already used in statute. Section two adds a new definition for who would receive an effective permit. Section three defines responsible bidder. Section 4 states that when a DNR timber sale contract with a purchaser of wood is not subjected to competitive bidding and contract approval. Section 5 and 6 are basically cleanup language on this bill. It requires the DNR to report to the Executive Council on the status of the state timber sales and management program. Section 9 is a lot of cleanup language. Eliminates securities such as bonds or notes as instruments in lieu of bond requirements for people who purchase state timber. Section 10, which we were just amended, basically deals with the permit having to cover the cost of the permit having to actually cover the cost of issuing itself or having itself issued, and section 12 of the bill deals with trespass information. This is information where if a trespasser is cutting state timber to an excess and damage greater than $100 or 10% of the single stumpage value of the timber that's unlawfully cut. Section 13 modernizes the statutes for the measurement of pulpwood by establishing weights for all species of pulpwood, and this is a wood weight that's been established between the buyers and sellers. Section 14 allows for a letter of credit or cash deposit by a logger to a county auditor for payment of timber on tax forfeited land, and section 15 is basically the repealers. Chairman Knobloch and members, this bill was fairly lengthy, but I'll let you know that this is a continuing work in progress by the Department of Natural Resources to clarify, codify, and eliminate some unnecessary language that's in statute now, and it is an effort to make current statute a little bit easier to read and follow on the issue of the timber industry here in the state of Minnesota. This bill passed out of both the environment committees on its way here, and is supported by the Department of Natural Resources. Doug Ford is here from Department of Natural Resources if there is any other questions pertinent to House File 823.
Questions or discussion on House File 823 as amended? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wayne, on page 2, starting on line 27 of section 4, can you just help me understand why we would want these improvements not to be bid out, and there's probably good reason, but if I could understand what that rationale is, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Blaine.
I'm gonna defer this to Mr. Ford here from the Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ford. Members, I'm Doug Ford. I'm the Timber Sales Program Supervisor for the Department. The reason for the additional language that appears starting on line 36 of page 2 to exempt the timber sales from the bidding provisions, approval provisions under Department of Administration rules, is it's a duplication of effort. Our permits are also reviewed by the Attorney General as the form and content, and are also publicly, openly bid, so that it was just a doubling up of requirements, and Department of Administration is in full agreement with us that they could add nothing to it if their procedure was doubled up on top of ours.
And Mr. Ford, to that same point, so then is there a statute somewhere that talks about how the department competitively bids timber sales?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, there is. It is part of Chapter 90. It's 90.14, I believe. 90.101 and 90.14 taken together, define our...
And Mr. Ford, is the process by which they are bid substantially the same as what the 16C process is for other state assets that would be sold that you're being exempted from?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, it is, and in addition, it's really an oral open bidding process.
When you say oral, Mr. Ford, you sound like an
oral option. Oral outcry, yes, as a formal option.
Okay. Any other questions or discussion? Seeing none, Representative Seifert renews his motion that House File 823, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Blaine and Mr. Ford.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is Mr. Lesh here? Representative Lesh here. Representative Lesh. The chair will move that Senate File 379 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Lesh, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for your patience, and sorry I wasn't here earlier. I have with me Judge Greg Johnson from the 2nd Judicial District. We have a pretty straightforward, simple bill here that allows us to streamline a process in Ramsey County and allows us to use a retired commissioner who would otherwise have to go to added expense and procedure. So I will let Judge Johnson explain the bill if that's okay with the chair.
Yes, sir. Please state your name for the record, sir, and give us your testimony.
All right. It's Greg Johnson. I'm the Chief Judge of the 2nd Judicial District. A person named James Finley was a court commissioner in our district for over 30 years. There were two court commissioners left in the state of Minnesota, one in Duluth and one in our district. He retired last year, and his position was sunset. We have asked him to come back and to work in our district on an intermittent basis due to the expertise that he has in commitments. Currently, with the sunsetting of the court commissioner position, we are able to hire him back as a court referee. Any decisions he makes as a court referee means it has to be reviewed by a district court judge at additional expense. And the difficulty with that is due to the oftentimes extensive record, it's very difficult for a district court judge then to review the work of a court commissioner as regards to mental commitments. The purpose of this legislation is to allow him have him come back on an intermittent basis where he would serve in the same capacity that he did when he was employed by our district as a court commissioner. It's been determined that there would be no fiscal impact as a result of that of this piece of legislation. He would be paid on a per diem rate of $291 per day, and that would come out of our district court budget. We are not asking for any additional funding from the state.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge or Representative Lesh, he has experience due to having done this for a long time. Does no one else, does he have special training? Is it just such a low incident area that that's the reason for this law?
What's happened since Commissioner Finley retired is that we are currently rotating district court judges through the commitment system. And what we're asking him to do is essentially to come back from time to time when a judge is on vacation or away at a conference, or if we have any type of opening due to, say, a judicial retirement or a judge leaving the bench. So it's just we would like to have the expertise that he has and be able to use it, and he is interested in coming back from time to time to work.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Greiling. It's my understanding that Mr. Finley does, in fact, have 20, 30 years of experience doing this, when a vast majority of other judges on the bench do not have anywhere near that amount.
Mr. Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, you called me Madam Chair before, so I just thought I would, you know.
Anyway, what training, I'd like to know, what training do the judges get that do mental health commitments?
Judge Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, all the judges in the state, the trial judges, are judges of general jurisdiction. All have law degrees and have a varying one degrees of expertise as well as years of service. As a judge is brought into our commitments area, it's expected that they will familiarize themselves with the law. attend any continuing legal education programs that become available and talk to other judges who have more experience. We don't have any particular training program that they go through other than as each judge in our district transfers from whether it's juvenile court, child protection, criminal or civil, it's expected that they will do whatever is necessary to learn the law and become familiar with it and procedures in a particular area.
Representative Greiling.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
I hope you don't mind if we have to have a little bit of fun in Ways and Means.
I haven't heard myself do that, so that I thought, what did you just say? Anyway, I would urge that there, I know that's not the purpose of this bill, but that there be some kind of training. I myself have appeared before Judge Finley on a couple of occasions, and I think that for my son, and I think that he could use a little training at times as well. There's a lot of things that change in the mental health field over the last 30 years.
Judge Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, I am well aware of that. We have, it's a new day for us, really, with Commissioner Finley retiring after 30-some years, and the judges in our civil division are the people that are rotating through commitments, and they take it very seriously. We're, in fact, in the process of establishing a mental health court in our district. I'm actually the person who has been involved in pushing for that, and will be the judge who will be handling our mental health court, and we're due to actually start that court on April the 25th. It's not a commitment court, but it's to deal with people who are charged with various criminal offenses, and the idea is it will be used as a diversion from the criminal system into the mental health system. So we take this area of the law very seriously, and the judges will receive the appropriate training.
I have Representative Biskins and then Dempsey. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Flesh, is there going to be a need to waive any rules when it comes to pensions and retirement funds if this legislation would pass?
Mr. Representative Lesh. And Representative Biskins, my understanding is no, that that was one of the things they looked into with respect to the fiscal note, and there was no other action necessary because this is taken entirely from the Second Judicial District budget. So the best I can answer that question is no.
Representative Biskins.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, to the best of your knowledge, then, there is no rules governing this gentleman and the amount he can earn in public service and still receive his entire retirement funds? Is that correct?
Representative Lesh.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, to the best of my knowledge, no.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge Johnson, why is only Ramsey County having this piece of legislation brought forth?
Mr. Chair,
Ed Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, because there are only two court commissioners in the state of Minnesota, one in the 6th Judicial District in Duluth and one in Ramsey County. The position in Ramsey County or the 2nd Judicial District was sunset at the retirement of Commissioner Finley. And so the reason that we're asking for this legislation is to allow him to come back and work in a retired capacity on an intermittent basis in the same capacity that he worked while he was employed by us.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And could you tell me the difference between what your particular piece of legislation does, what's the difference between it and what exists at the present time? Because it's my understanding that there are some judges that retire that can be called back and fill the gap, so to speak, where they might be needed throughout a district. And could you share that with me, the difference between this bill and what is already taking place?
Judge Johnson. Or Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dempsey. The reason for this is, you're correct, judges can currently do this. But Commissioner Finley fell into a loophole.
an area because he's a court commissioner, as Judge Johnson already stated, he wasn't able to take advantage of the same things that all the other judges in Minnesota would. We would anticipate that in the future, if this was a similar situation, it would be a judge in that role who were this specialized. Unfortunately, in Ramsey County, it happens to be a court commissioner, so he falls into a inverse loophole, as it were, and is unable to take advantage of this, and that's what this legislation does. It brings him back into the fold with the other judges.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other discussion to Senate File 379? Seeing no further discussion, the chair will renew his motion that Senate File 379 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Lesh and Judge Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, next we're going to call back Mr. John Walls, Fiscal Analyst for Transportation, to complete the review of the transportation budget that we had interrupted by adjournment in the last meeting. Mr. Walls, welcome back to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the handouts, I think the handouts are being passed. They're dated as of for the presentation last week, so we'll say March 7th on the front of the packet material.
And we're passing those out right now, members.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm going to start at the beginning and just try to go through some of the things that I had gone through last week in very quick fashion. And if members have any questions, just feel free to stop me, and I'll take time to answer them. Mr. Chair, on the inside first page, it's just a listing of the three agencies that the Transportation Finance Committee appropriates to, and those are essentially the Department of Transportation, the Metropolitan Council, and the non-judicial or crime-related functions of the Department of Public Safety. The Transportation Finance Committee appropriates roughly $3.7 billion in direct appropriations each biennium, but of those, only $80 million per year are general fund direct appropriations. There are also statutory appropriations or a statutory dedication of $320 million of what used to be general fund money, and those are MVEST dedications, which are used for the backfill of the TAB fee cuts or registration tax cuts instituted by the former Governor Ventura in the one-third, one-third, one-third agreement of a few years ago, as well as property tax relief for transit systems throughout the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, the Department of Transportation has a few different offices that perform different functions. The Office of Aeronautics is responsible for providing aviation aids for private pilots throughout the state of Minnesota, as well as upkeep and maintenance grants for small airports throughout the state. Greater Minnesota Transit, which I'll talk about later, provides transit services throughout the state outside of the Seven County metro area. Freight, Railroads, and Waterways is an office that provides regulatory functions for motor carriers, as well as programs for railroads and waterways, some of which are financed through general obligation bonds for both railroad improvement and port development assistance. The main function of the Department of Transportation is state roads, which I'll talk about a little bit later, and that's the funding is provided from dedicated accounts from different transportation-related taxes. Mr. Chair, the Department of Transportation also is responsible for providing electronic communications infrastructure to state agencies throughout the state. These serve public safety functions, as well as electronic communications backbone for MnDOT's fleet, and agencies like the Metropolitan Council Transit System also use those communication systems. Local Roads is another office that provides pass-through assistance of transportation monies to counties and cities to provide road infrastructure. And, of course, the department also has an administrative function to oversee its offices within the department. Mr. Chair, the Metropolitan Council has three primary functions, at least as far as transportation is concerned, and that is the regular route bus system, oversight and management of the Hiawatha LRT and Metro Mobility Services in the Twin City area. Mr. Chair, moving down to the Department of Public Safety, the Transportation Finance Committee also provides appropriation for Public Safety Administration, the State Patrol, Capital Security, Driver and Vehicle Services, Traffic Safety, and Pipeline Safety as well. Mr. Chair, that will take me to the third page of the handout, which is a flow chart of major dedicated state transportation tax revenue. Mr. Chair, the gray shaded areas represent the major dedicated sources for the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, the first of which is the motor fuels tax. Currently, 20 cents per gallon is the state level of tax for motor fuels sold in the state. That raises roughly $32 million per penny of gasoline, or $32 million per penny on gasoline sold in the state. The second major source of revenue is the registration or tab fees. That's currently raising $466 million per year. Other sources of revenue include highway fines, license fees, transaction fees paid at the department, through driver and vehicle services. This raises about $54 million. And the last major source is MVEST, or the motor vehicle sales tax, and that is in the lower shaded box. That raises about $568 million a year, 30% of which goes to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, about $8 million to Greater Minnesota Transit. $262 million is currently flowing to the general fund, and about $122 million annually towards Metro Transit. Mr. Chair, the center box, which represents the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, is a major collecting fund for all of these major state transportation revenues. This is dedicated 95% of the funds dedicated by the Constitution. 5% is dedicated by statute. The 5% may be changed every 6 years, no more often than every 6 years. And since we have gone beyond the last change was over 6 years ago, that 5% may be reallocated by the legislature at any time. The current allocation of that 5% statutory dedication is 53%, 53.5% to a flexible fund, which can be determined by the governor to flow either to the Trunk Highway Fund or to county turnbacks, 16% to the town bridge account, and 30.5% to the town road account.
Excuse me, Mr. Walls, that 5% every 6 years, is that 6 year provision in the Constitution? I forget. Or is that statutory?
Mr. Chair, I believe that is statutory.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the Highway User Fund then flows to three different distribution funds, the largest of which is the Trunk Highway Fund. Of the $1.34 billion collected by the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund this year, the Trunk Highway Fund will receive about $789 million, of which will be spent on highway purpose items such as road construction and maintenance and state patrol. The county state aid highway account will receive $436 million of the $1.34 billion, and that will be distributed to the counties throughout Minnesota for their county road infrastructure. And the last recipient is the Municipal State Aid Streets Fund, and that will receive $114 million this year for municipal street construction and maintenance.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Walls, the proportion of the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund that goes to trunk highways, county state aid highways, and municipal state, who sets that ratio so that we arrive at these numbers? Is that statutory or constitutional?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, it's a combination of statutory and constitutional. Most people are familiar with what is generally referred to as the 62-29-9 formula set in the Constitution between the trunk highway, county state aid, and municipal state aid. There is 5% on top of that set by statute, which is the formula that I just went over before. On the average, for internal planning purposes, I believe MnDOT uses the formula for when those two different allocations are sort of balanced out. The Trunk Highway Fund receives about 58.9% of all revenues. About 32.5% goes to the counties, and about 8.55% goes to the Municipal State Aid Streets Fund.
Yeah. Representative Beard. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Walls, then, just to follow up on that, then, the within the county state aid highway box or the municipal state aid box, those splits between the different counties, are those are established in the Constitution, correct?
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, those are set in statute.
In statute.
The,
okay,
the current formula for county state aid highway is there's a, of all the money collected in that account, there's a 10% equal distribution for construction, equal distribution to each county. 10% is based on vehicle population, 30% is on lane miles within the county, and 50% based on needs. For municipal state aid streets, it's split differently, 50% population and 50% money needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue, Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, the current motor vehicle sales tax formula that I have noted in this page continues on through fiscal 2008, and then it will revert to 46.25% to the general fund, 32% to the highway user. The distributions for Greater Minnesota Transit and Metro Transit will drop to 1.25 and 20.5, respectively. Mr. Chair, going on to the next page is essentially a memo just giving some background and outlining Metropolitan Council Transit. I'll just quickly go through this and say that about 80 million rides were provided in the Twin Cities by the Met Council in 2004. That compares to 9.4 million rides in outstate Minnesota. They're currently operating on a budget of about $300 million a year for transit, and that includes the regular route service, the opt-out communities, LRT in the Hiawatha corridor, and contracted service. And, Mr. Chair, at the bottom of the page, you can see a table of what the 2004 annual budget totaled and the different sources of funds that went into those. I might point out that in the federal aid column, the 19.1 shown for regular route service, I believe, is all for capital and not operating. And there is some federal operating money that goes into the LRT system currently from CMAQ funds. However, the federal government has gotten out of the business of major operating subsidies for large metropolitan areas. They still do some for smaller, more rural areas, but the assistance that they now provide to major metropolitan areas tends to be capital only.
Mr. Walls, I've got a question. I guess I've never looked at this that closely, but on the previous page, I see that Greater Minnesota Transit gets about 1.43% and Metro Transit gets 21.5%. So I'm doing a little bit of math. It looks like Greater Minnesota Transit gets maybe about 6% of the money. And yet when I'm looking at the rides, Greater Minnesota's got 9.4 million rides and the Twin Cities Met Council has 79 million rides. It looks like they've got 11-12% of the rides. You know, I guess I would kind of think that there'd be some connection between how much money the different transit authorities got and how many rides they provided. Do you have any sense for why there doesn't appear to be much of a connection here?
Mr. Chair, the federal government has different formulas of what type of aid it provides based on what kind of a system it is, either in a major metropolitan area or the more rural areas. When the MVES percentages were set to replace property tax levies, essentially the basis for the computation of operating assistance in the metro area based on property tax was vastly different from that set up in the rural areas. And so those percentages were set roughly just to take the place of the property tax, and there really wasn't any connection to the rides that they provide.
And Mr. Walls, is there, I mean, does the federal government provide a relatively greater greater subsidy to rural transit authorities? Is there any difference there?
Mr. Chair, if we want to skip ahead a couple pages to the Greater Minnesota Transit operating.
Well, that's fine. I'll let you go back. If you've got some more coming, that's okay. We can get to that later if you want.
Okay. Mr. Chair, on the following page of the memo, there was just a little bit of history of the property tax replacement and some information of the average subsidy per rider in 2003. 2003 is the most up-to-date data I have on that on subsidies per ride. Going on to the following page.
Excuse me, I've got a question from Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we leave the topic in regard to light rail transit, is that are we making a profit in regard to that service?
Mr. Rawls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, as with I believe all transit services in the state of Minnesota, some subsidy is required. There isn't any, except for there might be an occasional route or two that are so packed at all times that it turns a slight profit. But for the most part, all transit in operation receives a subsidy. While it is true, though, that they are collecting more than they anticipated when they started up the line because ridership has been above what they projected, they still receive dollars from the state, from the federal government, and from local governments to help fund that service.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then I was noticing on Mr. Walls on the on under property tax is the amount that the average person on a $150,000 assessed valuation home. Is that $52.47, is that sufficient enough to help support the costs?
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, that $52 impact is to pay for a capital levy. Every year the Met Council comes before the Tax Committee to give authority to levy property tax for capital only. And that is to fund new buses as well as service debt on bus facilities and transit stations and the like. So that is what that $52 goes to provide funding for. There is no longer a property tax levy in the metro area for transit service.
Okay, and Mr.
Representative Dempsey.
And then is that levy sufficient to pay for the costs, or at least partial for the costs of the transit?
Well,
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, that levy is sufficient to pay the debt service required for the retirement of those bonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For anybody that's interested, there are no mass transit systems in the United States that do not need subsidy from some unit of government. Secondly, the Met Council's operation is one of the highest percentages returned from farebox in the country, and I think it's in the high 30s, but that's the way the world is in mass transit.
Representative Sikora.
I was just wondering, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Mr. Walls, can you just say what is the actual subsidy amount per rider on LRT or per rider on a bus, et cetera? I don't, you know, I feel like that's something that we should know, but I don't really know what those numbers are exactly.
Yes.
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sephora, that is on the table on the second page of that memo. The subsidy per ride for regular route service in 2003 was about $2 per ride. LRT has yet to be determined because we have yet to complete a full year of full operation and find out what that subsidy is going to be versus the collections that they receive. You can see, for instance, some of the other services like Metro Mobility or community-based services, it can run $13 to close to $20 a ride. And the reason for that is those are generally door-to-door services that don't run on fixed schedules, are far more difficult to plan and provide for, and that's why there's such a great expense.
May I just ask Mr. Chair, Mr. Walsh, what is the definition of a regular route? Because I was told by my Metro Council representative that once you get past the borders of the city of Minneapolis, we're talking $8, $10, $12, $14, $15 a ride. Is that possible?
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sikora, I don't know if that rings a bell with me. I would have to have more specifics to answer that question. The regular route services, just basically the regular routes that you would hear of, the 13As or the 12Bs or whatever running.
They're mostly within the city.
Most of them are within the city, but there is some express service to the suburbs with park and ride lots that's also considered regular route service for those express commuter buses.
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Walls, earlier I heard you say that the federal government is kind of getting away from subsidizing the subsidy and spending more of their money on capital expenditures. And since I've been in the legislature, I think we've seen kind of both happening. We're subsidizing the capital, we're also subsidizing the subsidy more. And I'm wondering, do you know, is that happening in other states? Just anecdotally, it seems like the things that I read about other metropolitan areas that are expanding their transit, a lot more of that seems to be funded locally than at the state level, whether it's on the property tax or a small percentage of a transit tax, like a sales tax. Do you know, or do you have any information about what's happening in other states? And do you know, as far as percentage of subsidy subsidized by the state, do we lead the nation as far as the direct subsidy to the subsidy from the state, or are other states up there with that?
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dorman, each transit system throughout the country, and I can't speak to all of them because I have limited knowledge of what each one is doing, but some have gone with local sales taxes to help pay for transit systems. Others have used property taxes and other mechanisms to fund their transit systems. The federal government, I believe it was about 8 years ago when they started to phase out the operating subsidies. However, at the time, they did not offer very much in the way of capital subsidies. And while they've eliminated pretty much the operating subsidies in their entirety for large metropolitan areas, those were replaced almost dollar for dollar with capital subsidies. So we're essentially getting the same amount of money, although it's now restricted to a different purpose.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that might be helpful to the committee, Mr. Walls, is, and I don't know if you have this information or if it's something we can get from Metro Transit, but I know Metro Transit has some documents that can demonstrate what the subsidy is for similar markets as the Twin Cities and what level of fare box recovery we have as it relates to other regions of similar size and nature. In addition to, it'd be also interesting to know what are those regions doing in terms of how they're looking at the future and their use of transit service and new starts and the like. And I think that would be interesting for folks to look at as well. I think it is important for us to know what's happening in other parts of the country as it relates to alleviating congestion. I think as it relates to the local taxes, I think in many cases they're regional taxes that fund some of the transit subsidy. And perhaps there's a nuance there that we ought to consider. But I have a question that relates to the U.S. Bill that passed last week out of the House. And I'm just curious if you've had the chance to see the details of how that affects Minnesota. I know there's some projected increase in funding. I'm wondering if you know what strings might be attached to that and how those extra highway funds might be distributed. Or perhaps it's just too early and you haven't had a chance to see that yet.
Mr. Rawls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Larson, I do not know the details. Getting back to your previous point and something that I forgot to mention, as part of Representative Dorman's question, we did have a presentation in the Transportation Finance Committee, and there was a consultant that was before the committee with comparisons of like-sized transit systems throughout the country that were similar in size to the metro area. And I believe our fare box recovery was, if memory serves correctly, we ranked about third.
Okay, Mr. Walls, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, just continuing to the Greater Minnesota Transit Operating Funds page. Essentially, their 2004 budget was about $38.1 million. And as you can see from the four major sources, it was $8.6 million from that MVEST dedication that serves as property tax replacement, $15.8 million from a general fund direct appropriation, $5.8 million from federal operating grants, and $7.9 million from local share. Mr. Chair, the local share can come in any form that the locals wish to provide. That, so fares would count against that local share, as well as property tax or whatever sources that they use. The local share varies depending on the type of transit system, but formulas require that no more than 20% of the operating money required for that system come from locals. In other words, Mr. Chair, the locals provide 20% or less of each of the different types of systems. And the service types are rural. Those are countywide and small town service. There are small urban for small cities outside the metro area, similar in size to Mankato. There's urbanized, which are the larger outstate cities. That includes Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester. And there's also elderly and disabled service. Mr. Chair, continuing on, I've just included...
Oh, and before you continue on, Mr. Wells, can you speculate any more on just the issue we talked about before in terms of why the amount of money that Greater Minnesota gets out of MVEST is relatively small versus the percentage of rides that Greater Minnesota has of rides in the state?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a history that goes back to when these formulas were put into place. Perhaps, I could ask for something from John Williams of Health Research, who has a much greater background on this subject. I would point out that the 20% local share, which may come from fares in Greater Minnesota, I believe they're required to put up 20% of their local share. However, the metro area transit system is now recovering somewhere between 25 to 28% of the share of the operating subsidy. So there's, I guess, a greater percentage coming from a local share in the metro area currently.
Okay. Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Balls. I just want to check my memory here. A couple times you've referred to the portion of the motor vehicle excise tax that is spent on transit and talked about property tax replacement. And I believe that's what, if I recall, the 2001 tax bill, when we dedicated those funds that way, it wasn't a windfall, I don't think, for Metropolitan Transit. I think that transit probably got about the same money, but rather it was property tax relief, as I recall. So I think it was scored at least that year as property tax relief. And so it would seem to me, well, I guess I'll ask that before I ask my other question. Is my memory right, Mr. Walls?
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dorman, it was provided essentially as property tax relief. And the money given to the Metropolitan Council was supposed to, at the time, I believe, be 20.5% at the time of the agreement, and then expand to 22.5% in future years to more keep up with the growth in property tax revenues. But due to budget shortfalls, that extra 2% dedication was done away with. So there's still, it had been projected that the metro area would get about 22.5%, and they're now at 20.5%.
Representative Dorman.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe this is a question better for you as opposed to Mr. Walls, who just deals in the transportation area. But if we can't afford the additional LGA that we put in the 2001 tax bill, we learned we couldn't afford that. How can we still afford this level of transit funding if that was just tax relief too? Mr. Chair, how do we still afford that?
Well, Representative Dorman, I think what you should do is we still have the tax presentation coming probably a week from today. I think I'd save that question for that discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe I will bring that up.
Well, I believe you will too.
Probably on the floor.
All right. Mr. Wall, Representative Hulbert.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, just so Representative Dorman knows, that additional 2% in law falls off in the TAILS budget. So currently it's not appropriated past the next biennium.
All right, Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, the next few pages are just essentially the spreadsheet for the governor's recommended budget and provides a little bit of information for base budget levels and the like. I don't want to spend too much time on this except to say it's essentially a status quo budget from the previous biennium with a couple minor exceptions, well, major exceptions, one being that there is a reduction of about $163 million of what we had previously planned would be appropriated for road construction. And that reduction is primarily due to the fact that we have not had federal reauthorization, and these dollars would essentially be federal dollars going into the program. And at this time, those numbers had to be brought back. Without getting too technical, it ties directly with the department's proposal a couple years ago of doing some federal advanced construction projects, and since that money has not been made available, those expenditures will have to be put off to future time.
Mr. Walls, let me just ask you a question on that. I understand the House passed the federal transportation bill just recently. Let's say we adjourn our constitutional date of May 23rd, and let's say the president signs the federal transportation bill on May 24th. Are we able to access all the dollars that would be available to us still then, or is there some necessity of us passing legislation that allows us to do that?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the soonest I've been led to understand that a federal reauthorization might pass would be May at the earliest. However, there is a provision in law that allows departments to spend unanticipated federal revenues if they go through the LAC process. So were we to receive extra dollars from the federal government, they would be able to expend those dollars given LAC approval.
Okay. All right, Mr. Walls, did you have anything else?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to, leaving the spreadsheet and going to the very last page, there is a proposal from the governor for this year to have a constitutional dedication of 100% of MVEST to transportation purposes phased in over a five-year period starting in 2008. And this table was just to outline what impact that would have on the general fund. And if I can just go through it quickly.
Okay, and members, this is not in the last page of the packets, but is a separate sheet that is a one-sheet table like this that I think Mr. Walls is talking about. Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, the first column, the MVEST total, that's just the projected amount of MVEST that will be collected. That's 100. That represents 100%. Currently, 46.25 of that is going to the general fund. The MVEST new money column represents new money to transportation, or you could presume that that would be money lost to the general fund. And essentially, in 08, it puts an additional 10% towards transportation. In 09, it goes to 20%. In 2010, 30%. In 2011, 40%. And in 2012, the last 6.25% go to transportation purposes. And so in 2012 is the year that it's fully phased in. And of the column MVEST new money to transportation, the remaining columns just show the share that each area of transportation would receive under the governor's proposal.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this the new anticipated MVEST money that we were just talking about the other day? Is this the new predictions under the new... what am I trying to say? February forecast?
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, I believe the chart is up to date with February forecast numbers for MVEST. And the governor's proposal, I believe, once fully phased in, will put 60% of the revenues towards highway purposes, both construction and maintenance, and 40% to increased funding for transit.
Any other questions for Mr. Walls? If not, Mr. Walls, thank you for your presentation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vandeveer.
I do have one question. Do you know what percentage of people ride transit currently?
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vandeveer, I don't know off the top of my head. I believe, I think the statistic is for the metro area where it's, I believe, slightly above 3% of all daily trips are taken on transit and 97 in other vehicles, but I would have to get back to you with a more precise figure.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Walls, somewhere around 3% of the people use it, and the governor's plan takes what percentage of...
Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vandeveer, the governor proposes 40% of MVEST revenues be dedicated to transit in the metro area and outstate Minnesota.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Walls? Okay, thank you again, Mr. Walls. And members, we're having the overview of Minnesota school finance passed out. We'll have Mr. Crow start us with that. I don't know if we'll get through this completely. I would plan to adjourn 2:25 at the latest to give people a chance to prepare for session. Otherwise, if we don't get through this, I expect we'd come back and pick it up probably a week from today. Mr. Crow, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I have put a packet of information together for you. I just want to start with the note that there are two things that I won't cover today that I'd be happy to answer any questions about. One is, this is a discussion of how the state funds schools, in other words, how much we pay over time, some trend information. I don't have anything in this packet about how much individual schools receive or descriptions of kind of the complex formulas that allow us to figure out how much each school is going to get. That would probably be another couple of hearings for some of you who have heard that discussion. The other thing that's not in here is information about the governor's budget. Again, I'd be happy to answer questions about that, but I thought I'd focus mostly on current law and where we've been. So if you turn to the first page, there's a table that I'm sure you've seen before breaking out the state's general fund budget, the $30 billion proposed or projected for fiscal 2006-2007. So you can see K-12 education is 39.7% of that, or about $12 billion for the biennium, roughly $6 billion per year. And that's detailed on the chart on the next page. Page 3 basically just shows that for 1 year rather than for a biennium. But as you can see, for fiscal 2006, the base budget for the state general fund is about 40% for education, for K-12 education, and that includes early childhood and family education. The next section of charts deals with property taxes. I've included these because about 20% of the funding provided to school districts in the state of Minnesota comes from local property tax levies. These levies can be broken down into voter-approved and non-voter-approved. The ones that are non-voter-approved are ones that you as a legislature sets the amount that individual districts can raise and sets the limits on those and sets the districts that can qualify for those. So in addition, with the voter-approved levies that districts pass, your decisions here set limits on those as well and have an impact on whether those actually get passed. Page 5, just to give you a little bit of context, shows total taxable market value by property type. And the reason we include this is because school property taxes are levied against two different tax bases. In general, market value and tax capacity. When we go, we'll look on the next page at tax capacity. But basically, if you just put in your mind that residential homestead property accounts for about 60% of the $412 billion of property value in the state, and commercial industrial 15%. But as you see on the table on page 6, because we levy against net tax capacity, the spread of property tax paid isn't in direct proportion to the amount of market value in the state. You can see that the $5.7 billion of property taxes paid, about half, less than half, are paid by residential homestead, and 35% are paid by commercial industrial properties. So more than double the amount of property value in commercial industrial pays, and that's because of the net tax capacity, where we assign class rates to different property types, and that tax capacity system skews the total amount of value toward commercial and industrial and away from homestead. About half of our levies are levied on market value, the biggest one being your local operating referendums, voter-approved operating referendums. The largest of the net tax capacity levies is the your local voter-approved debt payments for school building projects.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering if these figures include both capital and operating, or if we're only on operating here or what?
Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, this includes everything which would include capital.
Thank you.
So then you can see on page 7 the breakout of property taxes payable by unit of government. School districts is down to 24%. In the past, it was much higher until the state takeover of the general education levy during the 2001 legislative session for 2002 and 2003. On page 8, I put a chart in for your information about where school enrollment has been in the past and where we project it in the future. As you can see, right now we're kind of at the top and starting down a very slight decline. The total school population has been growing since 1984 or so, since the early 80s, and it's been pretty flat, declining at a rate now of a couple percent per year. So, and that trend is expected to continue for the foreseeable future. The lower lines are a little difficult to read, but basically shows you the dashed line is the number of non-public students, which remains pretty steady at a little under 100,000, and then the number of homeschool and charter school students, which as a percent is growing, but as a percent of those populations is growing, but as a percent of total school populations looks pretty flat on this chart. Page 9 and 10 are just kind of informational charts showing you where the enrollment is at. The bulk of it's in the 7-county metro area, and the bulk of it is in the largest quintile of districts. Page 9 shows you 53% of students are enrolled in the 7-county metro area. Page 10 shows that 70% of all students are enrolled in 20%, the top 20% of districts in terms of size. If you go to page 12 then, what this chart shows is school funding, the percent that comes from the state versus local property taxes. This chart does not include local fees for such things as athletics or school lunches, nor does it include federal funding. So you can see that for the past, past 4 years leading into fiscal 07, we've stayed in the low 80% in terms of state funding, state percentage of all school funding. The number goes down as we project into the future, and again, this is under current law. The number is projected to go down primarily as property values grow and formulas that are equalized shift more from state aid to local property tax levies. The large jump in 03 that you see, where it got up to 92%, is the year that we instituted the general education levy takeover. And then it dropped down in 04 as a great multitude of districts went out for new operating levies following that state takeover and some of the things that happened with operating referendums during that year.
Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Crow, I'm sorry, maybe you mentioned this at the outset, but for on your current chart, the percent from state sources, is this under the current law or is this under the governor's proposal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krenke, this is under current law. Under the governor's proposals, these numbers would shift by about 2% upward in 06 and 07. Two to maybe 3%. I haven't done it with the new governor's, with the new budget.
With the supplemental.
With the supplemental budget.
Okay. That's good. Thank you.
All right. Please continue, Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair and members, page 13 is a historical look at how big, how much of the state general fund budget has been taken up by education finance. As you can see, for about 5 years going into fiscal 2007, it's been at about 40%, and again, that was after the takeover. For about 7 years prior to that, it was at about in about the 35% range, and it sort of steps down, you know, kind of stays consistent, and then steps up every 5 to 7 years. Almost 5% each of those years, and there are some reasons it went up in 04 and 05, primarily because the budget cuts that occurred for 04 and 05 disproportionately affected non-education areas of the budget. In other words, the reduction in education was smaller relative to the reductions that were made in the other areas of the budget. And then if we go to page 14. This is a graphical representation of the of 1 year of what was on in one column on page 12 for fiscal 2006. This reproduced really well, all these black pies. But basically, the little white slices are dividing the two very large black slices. State appropriations account for 80% of funding to schools. Tax credits, which is also state appropriations, is 1%, and then you see the levy at about 18%. And dedicated funds primarily is the permanent school trust fund, which is about $500 or $600 million that the interest is allocated to reduce the state cost of the state appropriation for general education. The chart on page 15 is admittedly difficult to read because of the smallness of the numbers.
Representative Krenke.
I'm sorry, Mr. Crowe. Just I know that this is just state fund. What would happen to the pie chart on 14 if we added in federal funds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krenke, federal funds are about $500 to $600 million per year. So the pie slice would be about 10%. We'd wedge a 10% slice into there.
I'm sorry, you said the actual dollars are
about $500 to $600 million per year.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, page 15 then is the data from which the charts on the previous pages were made. So if you're curious about the actual dollar amounts that go into those percentages, that's where they're at. About halfway down this page, you see a line that says percent state. That's where that the chart on state share is. The above the footnotes, there's a calculation of total revenue per average daily membership, which is noted as ADM, which is a raw, just a head count, unweighted total of the kids attending public schools. And you'll see up and down shifts, or you'll see movement up and down in that number, and it primarily comes on this table from the accounting shifts that we've instituted in the past and most recently in 2003 to save the state general fund money by doing accounting shifts to move money between fiscal years that really has no overall effect on school district revenue, but does have a budget savings effect on the state budget. Now, if you look at page 16, that's total revenue including aid and levy, basically describing where all the money that the districts get, what kind of categories it's given to them. The biggest piece is general education, about 70% of the school districts of school district revenue or of state appropriations for school purposes, and most of that money is it goes into school district's general fund and is available to be expended however the district wants to spend it. About 90% of that money would fall into that category. You can see the next largest sized piece of pie is the facilities and technology area. This includes both construction and deferred maintenance and our other maintenance, health and safety maintenance funding programs. And then special programs, the biggest part of that is obviously special education. And then the 7% pie, the fourth largest referendum, is local voter-approved operating referendums for school districts. And the dollar amounts broken out between aid and levy are on page 17. So you can see, for example, if you look at general education at about $5 billion, it's $4.9 million of aid and about 160, or I mean, 4.9 billion of aid and about 160 million of levy. Referendum is about 110 million of aid and about 400 million of referendum. And the
Mr. Crow, let me ask you a question about this. So then, if I'm looking at referendum 7% here, then I go back a few pages to the estimated current law figure of 80% coming from state sources, 20% coming from other sources. I guess is that other 20%, does that include federal too?
Mr. Chair, no. That's just the breakout between state funding.
Okay, that's what I thought. So yeah. then is the rest, if you've got a difference between 20% and 7%, is the rest levies like health and safety that can be put on without voter approval?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The 18%, the 80-20 mix includes referendum in both the 80 and the 20. 80% is the state aid that's provided to districts. So to the extent that part of that referendum amount is paid by the state, when a district passes a referendum, if they have low property value, the state actually provides that money to them. So if you look on this chart on page 17, And you look at the referendum aid at $110 million, and then the referendum levy at $405 million, the $110 is included in the 80% because that's state funding. Even though the voters approved that dollar amount, the state is actually providing the money to the school district. The taxpayers are not. And so included in the 20% then is everything listed under levies, including a portion of the referendum levies.
So of the 20%, only about one-third is actually voter-approved levies for operations. The rest is either voter-approved levies for constructing new schools or things like the health and safety levy or other levies that don't require voter approval.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. You can see the facilities levies. Now, some of those are voter-approved, are at $800 million. About $500 million or $600 million of that is voter-approved. The balance is things like health and safety, alternative facilities, building lease, things that the legislature allows districts to do without voter approval.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where would the equalization monies come in there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, the aid under the on page 17, under aid at the top, where it says referendum aid, that $110,500,000, that's referendum equalization aid. And the $46 million under facilities and technology, about $25 million of that is debt service equalization aid. A different kind of equalization, but the same concept for debt service.
Good.
Mr. Chair, then page 18 it basically says, okay, now instead of looking at just or at looking total revenue, how is the state aid money split out? And that's where you see that the levy part is skewed toward the kind of special things, and the state aid part is skewed here, as you can see, 84% toward general education, which is again the large amount of undesignated revenue that each school district would have. And where facilities was you know, 10% or 11% of the total pie, the state doesn't actually contribute very much to that. So it's about 1% of state aid or state assistance to schools. So the biggest pieces of what the state does is general education and special education. Now, I should note that the definition of general education, the technical definition of general education, includes referendum revenue. So in that, 84% is the $110 million of referendum aid as well. And so there's a breakdown on page 19. If you just look at levies rather than just looking at page 18 is just looking at aid, page 19 is just looking at levies, gives you that breakdown of what's voter approved, what's not voter approved, and of the voter approved, you can see, you know, it's about 40% for the debt fund, which is debt service on building construction, and 28% of the total is operating costs that are voter approved. And you can kind of see the breakout of what's voter approved, what's not voter approved, and which funds those are in, the general fund, the debt fund, or the community services fund. Then that 84% we looked at on page 18, that pie that showed the big chunk of general education revenue being 84% of their state aid, well, how does that break out? Well, that's on page 20. If you look at the $5.5 billion for fiscal 06 that's in general education, we actually calculate general education from a variety of different formulas. The largest formula is the one you hear the most about. 77% of the funding for general education comes from the basic formula. That's the $4,601 per pupil that every school district gets. That's the formula that's referred to when the governor made his 2% and 2% increase was to that part of the formula. The revised supplemental budget has 2.5% and 2.5%. This is the largest part of any school district's budget, is this basic revenue. Again, it's 77% of the 84% of state aid that you provide. Again, you can see the referendum, that's $110 million, it's about 9%. The third largest piece of the pie is compensatory revenue, which is based on the number and concentration of free and reduced price lunch students in an individual school building within the district. And then the next largest and the only other piece of pie with any significance is operating capital, which is the amount of money a district gets for maintenance and other purposes, and it's based on the age of the building. And the dollar amounts for that pie chart are on page 21. So if you look on page 22...
Mr. Crow, before you get to that, let me just ask if anyone's got any questions on your presentation so far. Okay, because I think what I'm going to do, any further questions, I think what I'm going to do is, knowing that we can't finish off the whole presentation, I think this is maybe a good place to take a break. And we will have you, Mr. Crow, come back probably a week from today to finish off the presentation, if that will work okay. So thank you very much for the presentation so far, Mr. Crow. Appreciate it. Members, I will be making an announcement soon about a possible meeting on Thursday to consider the budget resolution, but just tentatively, I think it's likely that we will take up the budget resolution in a special Ways and Means Committee meeting this Thursday after session. Stay tuned for the formal announcement. With that, seeing no further questions or discussion, the meeting is adjourned.